I'm the introvert of the staff. Believe it or not, I'm an extreme introvert that happens to be called into an extroverted job. So I just want to say to all of those introverts out there who were bold enough to pray with one another, particularly if you happen to be praying for and with a stranger, I feel you. And well done. You survived, and that's awesome. Anne Lamott said this marvelous thing. I love this. I keep going back to this image, where she said, life is one big emergency room. And we're either the ones in need of help, or we're the ones actually called to do the helping. And it won't be long before the roles change. You know, everybody, we like to wear a mask. We like to kind of let one another know that we're okay. We got this. Yet my guess is every single one of us is fighting some battle that the rest of us know nothing about. Every single one of us is probably carrying some burden, heavy or light, that we keep to ourselves. Every single one of us probably is wrestling some demon that we just can't quite get our hands and heart around. And I know that every single one of us is journeying through some wilderness of loss and grief. You know, I was told, we're often told that the goal in life is to be happy. That sounds reasonable. I don't mind that myself. But I'm wondering if a more helpful and realistic goal is to actually learn how to be unhappy. To learn how to be unhappy with grace, resilience, hope. Because we spend a fair bit of time in that arena, because life, as much as we wish it were, it's not fair. Life is loss. Loss is constant. It's a part of our reality. There's the loss of someone we love. There's the loss of our health, perhaps. The loss of a dream. The loss of hope. There's the loss of one way of looking at the world. Loss is life. Loss is constant. So I think not only, I think, should the goal be, you know, by the way, it's still okay to encourage one another to be happy. Nothing wrong with happiness. But not only should the goal also, in addition to that, learn how to be unhappy with grace. I think the goal also should be, because life is heartbreaking. Life just has this way, often when you least expect it, to break your heart. So I think one of the goals is to learn how to be sanctuary and a soft place to land for one another when our hearts are broken. It says in Psalm 23, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'm not afraid, for thou art with me. Notice it doesn't say, if I walk through the valley of shadow of death. It says, though I walk. Knowing that we all walk through the valley of the shadows, again and again and again. So part of the challenge and part of the gift when we walk through the valley of the shadows, I think one of the greatest gifts we can provide for one another is to walk side by side, to let each other know, you're not alone. I'm with you. So we turn to a beautiful story today. This summer, if you're new to us, this summer we're looking at some characters from the Hebrew Bible, some characters from what is often called the Old Testament. We're taking a peek into their stories and see if we might learn something about our stories. And today is the story of two incredibly beautiful women, Naomi and Ruth. It's the book of Ruth, But I actually think it should be called the Book of Naomi and Ruth, because the story really in many ways is about both of them. The Book of Ruth, you'll find it's the eighth book, starts in Genesis, the eighth book, right after Judges. It's actually four chapters, only four. There's 86 verses in the Book of Ruth. It's a beautiful story, a love story. You could actually read it this afternoon. But before I share a little bit about this incredible relationship between Naomi and Ruth, I want to give you just a little bit of a background so that you can hear when I read from chapter 1, you kind of get the context before I read. So it begins with a family. It begins with a Jewish family. Elimelech is married to Naomi, and they happen to live in Bethlehem. Have you heard of Bethlehem before? So they live in Bethlehem in Judah, and they have a couple sons, and their sons' names are Kilian and Milan. And there's a severe drought and there's a famine in Bethlehem, so severe that Naomi and Elimelech and their sons are forced to flee, to go across the river to a place called Moab, which actually is modern-day Jordan. And the two sons, while there, fall in love and marry two young Moabite women, one by the name of Orpah and the other by the name of Ruth. Now, as we read it, if you read it this afternoon as four chapters, you might just quickly gloss over and not notice the significance of that. So Naomi and Elimelech and their sons left Bethlehem because of a severe drought and famine and went to Moab. What you may not know if you didn't read the first seven books of the Bible is that Moabites are the dreaded enemy of the Israelites. If Israel at that particular time the Bible was written had an immigration policy, there'd be a travel ban on Moabites because they were regarded as undesirable and they wouldn't be let into the country. So think of the fear. So there was a drought and famine in the land. Think of how afraid you must be to leave your land, Bethlehem, and to go into enemy land where you will be hated because you've heard there might be food there. You know, so often when we hear things like immigration and refugee status, when I hear some of these conversations, I get the sense some people think people are traveling to just get better scenery. It's life and death. It's survival. When there's no food, when you fear violence, when you're in danger, when there is no hope in your own homeland, you flee. So imagine Naomi and Elimelech, they not only flee, they become refugees in enemy territory. You know, when it's a matter of survival, those lines that we draw on a map that we call borders mean nothing when it's life and death. So Naomi, Elimelech, and their two sons, and the sons' wives, who are now the daughter-in-laws of Elimelech and Naomi, now live in enemy territory, Moab. They're refugees. And everything settles. And just like that, it changes in an instant. Do you ever notice life is like that? Everything settles. And just like that, everything changes. Everything turns upside down. Elimelech dies. A few years later, their two sons die. Unspeakable tragedy, inexplicable grief. Can you imagine? Here's Naomi, this Jewish woman, her two daughter-in-laws, Moabites, Orpah and Ruth, bound together by their heartbreak, by their grief, by their loss. But they're women. They're women in a male-dominated, patriarchal, oppressive system. Meaning at this particular time, when their husbands have died, they are the most vulnerable in society of anyone. When their husbands die, they not only have experienced the loss of their husbands, but because of this society, this male-dominated society, they've lost their social standing. They've lost all economic security. They probably have lost, they've lost their homes. And there's no social net to catch them. They're living on the margins now with no social net. That's why the Bible again and again and again says, care for the widows and the orphans. Because there's no social net. They're left on their own. So there's no such thing as a loss. Many of you have experienced loss. What happens when we experience loss is there's a cluster of losses, right? So they lost their husband, but they lost everything else around that. And we too experience that when we experience loss. There's this cluster of losses. Say, Naomi is desperate, and she decides, I'm going to return back to Bethlehem because I've heard this rumor that the famine has ended, so I'm going to go throw myself at the mercy of my extended family and hope to God that somebody might take care of me. Well, the daughter-in-laws start following with her, and Naomi insists, no, you stay. You stay in your own homeland with your own families. You're young. There might be a chance for you yet. You still might be able to get married. You still might be able to have children. Again, in that society, without that possibility, they had no future. And Naomi was probably also thinking, so here I am in Moab as a refugee, as a widow, on my own. There's not much hope. Just as she was probably thinking, my daughters-in-law, Moabites in Bethlehem, refugees in enemy territory, they too would not be welcome. So Naomi says, stay. Well, Orpah, I think understandably and maybe even wisely, does what her mother-in-law asks. She stays with her family, in her land, in her religion. Because not only think of the character of this family, think of Elimelech and Naomi, who take in two people who represent the enemy, who are part of a different religion, a different race, a different ethnicity. That says something about who they are. But Ruth refuses to leave Naomi. And probably one of the most selfless, courageous, compassionate acts, she says, I'm by your side. You got me. I will never leave you. It's going to be hard, the valley of the shadows that we're walking, but we'll do this together. So with that background, oh my gosh, let me read from Ruth chapter 1. Are you with me so far? Okay. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. A certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife Naomi. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were from Bethlehem. They went into the country of Moab, remained there. Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. The two sons who had taken Moabite wives, one of them was named Orpah, the other one was named Ruth. They were together for about 10 years. Mahlon and Chilion also died. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. And the two women were left without their husbands and their father-in-law. Then Naomi started to return to Bethlehem. She heard the famine had ended. She set out from the place where they had been living, she and her two daughters-in-law, and they went on their way to go back to the land of Judah, to Bethlehem. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house in Moab. May God deal kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with me. The Lord grant that you may find security, each of you, in the house of your family." Then Naomi kissed them. The three of them wept aloud. And they said to her, No, we will return with you to your people." Naomi said, No, turn back, my daughters. It's far more bitter for me. The hand of God has turned against me." The three of them wept aloud. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law and returned. But Ruth clung to her. Naomi said, "Ruth, see your sister-in-law. She has gone back to her people. She's gone back to her gods. Go, return, go with her." But Ruth said, in what may be the most beautiful words in the entire Bible, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will become my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you." Naomi saw, I love this part, Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to be by her side. So she said no more. Isn't that a great story? So if we look at the story, if you read all four chapters, all 86 verses, the word turn, or a derivative of the word turn, appears 15 times. Almost as if the thread moving out throughout the whole book is about turning. Because sometimes in the midst of grief, we get stuck, and our perspective stays locked, and our heart stays locked. So the invitation is to keep turning. If you keep turning to God, turning to God, turning to God, turning to God, you'll get there. I collect kaleidoscopes. I'll come into my office. I have a whole bunch of them, and you can come play with me. But I collect kaleidoscopes, and amazing with kaleidoscopes, one turn, one tiny, tiny turn, and everything changes. Perspective changes, color changes, every hope changes. So I want to quickly, there's three turns, three movements in this first chapter that I just read. The first movement, it's turning towards your pain, turning towards one another, and turning towards hope. So the first movement that we see in this chapter, turn towards your pain. Life hurts. Life is hard. We live in a culture that likes to turn away from our pain, that likes to deny our pain, that likes to medicate our pain, that likes to numb our pain. What would happen if we actually turned towards our pain? You know, you've heard Richard Rohr, who said, "Pain that is not transformed just keeps being transmitted. Parker Palmer said, "Violence is what happens. Violence to ourselves, violence to others, is what happens when we don't know what to do with our suffering." In verse 13, it says, Naomi says, "God's hand has turned against me." You can almost feel the despair and the bitterness. Who can blame her? I mean, she's angry with God, and who can blame her? But I love what it says then. It says the three of them wept together. Spiritual health is honest. Just honest. See, if we're angry with God or we're in despair, so often we try to just hold it in there. Spiritual health is honest. I was talking with someone just the other day who wasn't making a whole lot of sense. And finally, after some time, she said, "I'm so sorry. I'm just not here. I'm not present. I'm not making much sense. My favorite aunt died just this morning." And I'm thinking to myself, how upside down is it that she felt the need to apologize to me for not being okay? Why isn't it acceptable just simply to say, "I'm not okay, and I need you. I just need you to listen," or more so, "I need somebody to cry with me." You know, if we hold that grief and that sadness and that anger and that despair, if we kind of hold it in, guess what? It comes out anyway. What a gift it is. What a gift it is if we can be the sanctuary, if we can be the container of grace that allows someone whose heart is broken to feel like they have permission to share with us their broken heart and to know that they will not be judged. Asking for help is not weakness. It's actually a desire to be strong. People in need, they're not looking for advice. They're not looking for answers. They're not looking for quick fixes. They're not looking for solutions. Kind of like Orpah and Ruth, they're looking for people who will be willing to enter into the darkness and weep with them. So turn towards your pain. The second one is, what is the second one? Turn towards each other. I combine those two. So there you go. Looked at the clock, I combined the two. But I do want to point one thing about this turning towards each other. Thank you for remembering. You paid attention in the first service. Thank you. That's awesome. The book of Ruth is the first book in the Bible where God doesn't speak. Where God doesn't show up. And I'm wondering if that's because the invitation in the book of Ruth is for us to be that presence. You know, if somebody's really hungry, you might talk till you're blue in the face about God. God will only be experienced for them in a loaf of bread. Somebody whose heart is broken, you might talk until you're blue in the face about God. God's presence might only be known and felt if you were like Ruth, who shared those beautiful words, who grabbed Naomi by the hand and said, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. I'm walking every step of this journey with you, and I will not leave you." The last, turn towards hope. You know, I've said a couple weeks ago, I think it was a couple weeks ago, I said, suffering, darkness, and death do not have the last word. It seems like it, but God does. And God's word is a word of restoration and healing and hope and of a love that never ends. I said it a couple weeks ago. I'm going to keep saying it, particularly at this particular time in life and history. I'm going to say it till I'm blue in the face. Love wins. And if love ain't winning, the story isn't over. This story of Ruth begins in inexplicable tragedy and suffering and despair. And Ruth grabs Naomi by the hand, Even though there's a degree of uncertainty for herself, her own grief, she grabs Naomi by the hand and say, I don't know where this trail is going. But we're going to walk this road together. Well, that's how the story begins. The story ends. So Ruth had to assume she had no future. She had to assume she had no life, no options. And she chose, out of great courage and compassion, to be a sacred companion to Naomi. The story ends. Ruth marries Boaz, who happens to be related to Elimelech. And they have a son by the name of Obed. Well, Obed becomes a grandchild to Naomi. Naomi, whose heart was broken, thinking there was no life, no hope for her, experiences healing in this grandchild she thought would never come. Obed gets married, and they have a son by the name of Jesse. Jesse gets married, and they have a son by the name of David. David becomes king. Ruth, the Moabite, the despised one, the widow, the vulnerable, becomes the great grandmother of King David. Well, there's another child, said to be of the house and lineage of David, a child of Bethlehem. His name happens to be Jesus. Ruth, the Moabite, the despised one, the widow, the vulnerable one, is the many times great grandmother of Jesus. And it began when, with an act of great compassion and courage, she grabbed Naomi's hand and said, I can't see the way forward. But where you go, I will go. I will not leave you or forsake you, and I'll be with you always. Which happens to foreshadow the very words of her great, 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 great grandson, Jesus, who said, I will be with you always. So if you find yourself on the road and you're thinking the story's over, turn. Turn the page. Turn towards hope. Turn to one another. Grab somebody by the hand. Be their sacred companion. And just take the next step. Because you really don't know where that road is ever going to lead. But what we're promised is that we will never be alone as we walk. We continue to worship God as the morning offering is received.